Lecture 48, The Grand Finale.
Welcome back, and thank you for coming back. This is the 48th lecture, and I want to commend you for sticking with it this long. I'd like to do several things for our last lecture together. One is I'm going to try to summarize 3,000 years of Egyptian history in maybe 5 minutes, because I want to put it all in perspective. I don't like to end on a down note with Cleopatra's death, and I want to show that her death is the end of a great tradition, and I'll even give you a little hope that it might continue. You'll see what I mean in a minute. Remember when we started, very first lectures, we were talking about a prehistoric people moving north into the Nile Valley, barely controlling fire, just having the ability to speak, and the only tool they had was a hand axe, and for 700,000 years, that was the only tool. But then, when we entered the historic period with writing, it all started to happen very quickly. Narmer unified Egypt. Egypt becomes the first nation in history. And we start to get great things happening. With a centralized government, the king can control irrigation ditches. You can get all of Egypt working for the common good, building things like the Great Pyramid of Egypt. It's an amazing civilization, and it happens quickly. And it lasts a long time. Think of the high points. You know, Sneferu showing Egypt how to build the pyramids, Thutmose III marching north, Ramses the Great, Hatshepsut, the woman who ruled as king. Cleopatra is the end of that tradition. When she dies, remember, she is almost like Isis, the goddess trying to protect her son, her infant son. She's living out a myth that all Egyptians knew for 3,000 years. But let me say something about what happens after Cleopatra's death. Because as I say, I don't like to end on a down note. Remember, Cleopatra had children. What happens to those children when Cleopatra dies with the bite of a cobra? Now, interesting, by the way, isn't it? That symbol of the king's protection is how Cleopatra chooses to die. She knew what she was doing. It was the cobra that was going to protect her from Octavian, bringing her back in chains and paraded in Rome. She knew what she was doing. She also was thinking about her children. Caesarion is about 17 years old when Cleopatra committed suicide. And she had plans for the dynasty to continue. She sent Caesarion with his tutor to the Red Sea with treasure. They were going to sail to India and start a new dynasty. But Caesarion was betrayed by that tutor. He was told, return to Egypt. Come back with me. It'll all be okay. But no, it wasn't okay. He was first brought back to Alexandria, and Octavian, seeing Caesarion, said, there can be too many Caesars, and had him killed. Right? There was going to be only one ruler. So Caesarion is killed. Now she's got three more children. Remember the twins? Alexander Helios, Cleopatra Selene, right? The twins. And she's got young Ptolemy, another son. Those three children are sent to Rome to be raised, believe it or not, by Antony's widow, Octavia. And she takes them in. She's always this perfect Roman wife. Now, some of the children, two of the children disappear from history. We don't know what happens to them. But we do know what happens to Cleopatra Selene. At the age of 14, she marries Juba II. He is the king of Mauritania. right? This is area around Morocco. She is married to Juba II. Now, Juba II is a scholar and a kindly man. And they have a good marriage, a very good marriage. And they have children. They have a son. And you know what they name? Ptolemy. And there's a daughter, Drusilla. Let me tell you how Ptolemy meets his end. Juba II, as I say, is a scholar. And he learns that from a shellfish, kind of shellfish, called a murex, you can extract a purple dye. It's very valuable, but very difficult to extract. And he learns the secret of extracting this purple dye, and it becomes an industry. They make a small fortune with this purple dye. And their son Ptolemy is given a cloak dyed purple, very purple. And of course, purple is the color of royalty. And Ptolemy goes to Rome to visit his cousin Caligula. That is Ptolemy's cousin. And Caligula sees this purple cloak, and because it's more purple than the things he's got, has young Ptolemy killed. So Cleopatra's grandson is killed by Caligula because his cloak is too purple. But the line may live on. Cleopatra may have descendants. Drusilla, right? The daughter, marries Antonius Felix, a governor of Judea. Now, we do not know if she has children. She disappears from history, but it is quite possible that Cleopatra's lineage lives on in the blood of Drusilla and her descendants. So Cleopatra may, in some sense, still live. But anyway, let me say some other things about why it's good that you've studied Egypt so long, these 48 lectures. We have a legacy that we owe to Egypt. And if you think back about all the things we've discussed, you'll see it's considerable. For example, our 365-day calendar. That's owed to Egypt. Papyrus, the origins of our paper. We owe that to Egypt. But I think more important, a lot of our religion is derived from Egypt and it's not acknowledged. For example, the obvious one is thinking back to Akhenaten, our heretic king of the 18th dynasty, who on the banks of the Nile became the first one to say there is only one God. Monotheism originates in Egypt. But there are more subtle things that we get out of this. Think about Christianity and how the Trinity, the very notion of the Trinity, perhaps comes from Egyptian gods that always came in triads, threes, Amun, Mut, and Khonsu, right? And the other Trinities. But also, let me suggest some real long shots. The Madonna and Child is very much like ancient Egyptian statues of Isis suckling the infant Horus. I wouldn't be surprised if they come right out of Egypt. And you know, when you look at Tutankhamun's golden coffin, look what he's holding in his hand. The signs of authority, a flail, but also a crook, a shepherd's crook, just like the archbishops carry, right? Comes out of Egypt. And if you look at the Pope's mitre, the hat that the Pope wears, it's the white crown of Egypt. It's the white crown. Also, the basic concept of resurrection. That's Egyptian. They believe in resurrection. The whole centrality of incense to ritual comes out of Egypt. So there's plenty that we owe to Egypt. Just one reason for studying Egypt in these 48 lectures. But let me end a little bit on a light, leitmotif. I want to talk about Egyptology's legacy in film and literature, kind of the fun stuff of it. There are loads and loads of mummy movies. And I think that if you now, given what you know about Egypt and Egyptology, look at these movies, I think you'll really have a lot more fun. The earliest movie, by the way, the earliest mummy movie that I know of, is about 1918, 1919, and it's called The Eyes of the Mummy Ma. It's a German film starring Pola Negri, right? And let me say this. It's before we had our concept of the mummy as this rapt fiend dragging across the screen. This mummy movie is so bad that you can't figure out who the mummy is. Truly. You watch the movie, you just don't know who the mummy is. But this was before the classic 1933 or so movie, The Mummy, starring Boris Karloff. Now, if you look at that movie carefully, you will see that there's a lot of good Egyptology in it, surprisingly. For example, look carefully at the beginning of the movie. You will see the what they call the scroll of Thoth. Now remember, Thoth is the god of writing. And you will see a scroll of Thoth across the screen. This is a real book of the dead. It's the Papyrus of Ani. And you can see that papyrus today in the British Museum in London. They were getting it right. If you look at some of the artifacts that are discovered and displayed, you will see they're replicas from Tutankhamun's tomb. And if you'll remember, it's an expedition in the 1920s that's about to discover. So this is Howard Carter. They're about to discover a tomb. And if you remember the name of the princess whose tomb it is, it's Ankhesenamun. Ankhesenamun, the widow of Tutankhamun, whose tomb disappeared. We don't know where her tomb is. So this is a little bit of a legacy of Egyptology. And there's one more little thing you should look for in that movie. Do you remember who the mummy's name is? What the name of the mummy is? It's not what you think. Many people think it's Karis. Nope. It's Imhotep. Imhotep, the architect of Zoser's step pyramid. And you know how powerful the image of the mummy is? This will surprise you. The mummy appears on the screen for no more than a minute in the entire movie. But that's what you remember, the mummy. Now, there are sequels to this classic 1933 movie. The best one, I think, well, there's actually three that come after it. Universal Studios, who made the classic Mummy, made so much money from this film that they had to have sequels, right? And they did several sequels. Boris Karloff didn't appear in any of them. And they're much more hokey than the first one. Because I think what's been lost is the personality of the mummy. In the first one, the mummy has a love. You care for the mummy. You kind of almost root for the mummy. In these, the mummy becomes this bandaged thing with no personality. But if you'll remember, the people who keep the mummy alive is the high priests of Karnak, right? And there's a medallion, right? A secret medallion. And to make the mummy come alive, that's where we get tana leaves, right? So it becomes, there are traces of Egyptology in these movies, but they become rather hokey. Now, the Indiana Jones one, where they're looking for the lost Ark of the Covenant, if you remember, back from our Tanite kings and our Libyan kings, they're looking for the Ark of the Covenant in Tanis, in the Delta, in Egypt. That's a little bit of Egyptology there. And if you look for these things in the mummy movies, I think you'll see there's a lot more to be seen in them. You know, the most recent mummy movie, the one called The Mummy, the 1999 movie, it's not really Egyptological. It's kind of much more sci-fi, high-tech mummy. But look carefully and you'll find Egyptology. It's a little bit wrong, but it's interesting to see. For example, do you remember that there are canopic jars in the movie that feature significantly? But how many were there? Well, in ancient Egypt, there were four. But in this movie, there are five. Right? They didn't quite get that right. Also, if you remember, thousands of scarabs are creeping all over. I mean, that's the scarab was always the protector in ancient Egypt, but here it's the destroyer. So we get themes in the movies that I think, given what you know now, I think will be more fun to watch and you'll pick up on things. So run out and rent a few of these movies and look at them. And I think the one that you really shouldn't miss is the Elizabeth Taylor Cleopatra film. Because you will see that it is very true to history. You'll see Pothinus, the politician who's advising. You'll see the bratty Ptolemy XIII on the throne. You'll see them all. And I don't know if you realize this, but the movie was an incredible financial disaster. Partly because it was so accurate. It got bigger and bigger and bigger. They included everything. But it's quite accurate in the sets. You should look at them carefully. You'll see things that we've talked about. But that's The Mummy in movies. Literature. We've got a long, long Egyptological tradition here. One that nobody reads anymore that I think you would all love is Théophile Gautier's The Romance of the Mummy. Right? Now, it's romance in the sense of a novel. Right? It's talking about, it's like a novel of a mummy. And it talks about a mummy as a romantic figure. Up until the Boris Karloff film, mummies were viewed as romantic things. You get stories about people falling in love with mummies. And in this novella, it's very short, there is almost a prediction. It's awesome. It's a 19th century novella, but it predicts the discovery of Tutankhamun's tomb. It talks about a poor archaeologist who teams up with a wealthy English lord searching in the Valley of the Kings, and they found an intact tomb. And it's a mummy of a princess. And in this novel, we get the wealthy lord, who is handsome, young, falling in love with the mummy. And he returns to England with it. And everybody always wonders why he never married. Right? And the suggestion is, he's got this princess in his study. Right? It's an interesting one. There's also Arthur Conan Doyle's short stories that you should pick up and look at. There's one called The Ring of Thoth. We get Tanna Leaves in his story, The Origins of Tanna Leaves. This is where you get mummies as perhaps, in some of his stories, there's a mummy called The Mummy from Lot 251 or some number like that, where a mummy is bought in an auction. And the mummy comes to life and kills people. She does. Right? It's a female mummy. Right? You get female mummies. You get mummies that people fall in love with in Conan Doyle stories. And then there's a classic, The Jewel of the Seven Stars by Bram Stoker. Now, Bram Stoker wrote Dracula. He wrote Dracula. But he also wrote this one, which is about a female mummy with a ring on her hand with her seven stars in it. She has seven fingers. It's quite a story. Go back. Some of them are hokey, but you will see Egyptology in them. Bram Stoker was reading about the current excavations. There are stories that involve Egyptology. And if you like modern ones, there's a whole series by Elizabeth Peters called the Amelia Peabody series. Now, let me tell you a little bit of a secret, not much of a secret. But Elizabeth Peters is a PhD in Egyptology from the Oriental Institute at the University of Chicago. Her real name is Barbara Mertz. And she wrote two of the early popular books on Egyptology, Temples, Tombs, and Hieroglyphs, and Redland, Blackland, that were the first big sellers in Egyptology. And now she writes the Elizabeth Peters sequence. And given what we've talked about for these 48 lectures, I think you'll see characters that will be recognizable, especially the hero of the series. It's Sir Flinders Petrie, the excavator. He is the hero of the series. And it's just like Petrie. It's a caricature. And there's wonderful Egyptology in that. She is a professional Egyptologist, and there's great, great Egyptological detail. There's about eight of those out now. I think you'd all enjoy them. One other kind of fictional thing we should talk about is Anne Rice's The Mummy. This is one in which we get, again, it's a kind of going back to the early literature of mummies where we get a romantic mummy. Right? We get a mummy that comes to life who's a handsome devil. Right? Reginald Ramsay's. Right? And he becomes the hero of the series. So there's plenty of fiction out there for you to read about Egyptology and mummies. Let me also talk about nonfiction. Let me talk about books that I think will interest you for your own special interest, whatever your interest is. We've covered so much in these 48 lectures that by now there are probably little aspects that interest you that you want to read more about. And let me suggest how to go about this. 20 years ago, when a book came out on Egyptology, it was a big deal. We all talked about it. Now none of us can keep up with the literature. There are so many books coming out on Egypt, and they're good books. Good books. And let me suggest how you can proceed with your own interest. For example, if you were interested in the lecture we did on medicine, there are books to get on medicine in ancient Egypt. There are translations, for example, even of the Edwin Smith Surgical Papyrus. You can actually get a translation and see what the Egyptians said. If you're interested in magic, look in the bibliography. There's an extensive bibliography at the end of our outline. There are books on magic. I've done one on Egyptian magic. There are some on... If you're interested, for example, in religion, there are probably 30 or 40 books that are good books on Egyptian religion. There's even separate books on the Osiris myth. 2 volumes just on Osiris. So whatever your interest is, that's where you should guide yourself. It shouldn't stop here with this course. There's plenty of books out there. Plenty. Now, remember the very first lecture? I said I had several goals. One was I was going to try to give you a broad perspective on Egyptian history. And we've done that, or at least we've tried. But the other is I said I wanted to spur you on to learn more. I wanted to let you know that it shouldn't end here with these 48 lectures. The good thing is you can take out the tapes and listen them again. But let me make some suggestions of things you can do, societies you can join, places you can go to continue the interest in Egypt. First, go to the primary source. If at all possible, go to Egypt. Walk the land. Walk through Hatshepsut's temple at Deir el-Bahari. Look on the wall. You'll see her expedition to Punt. Walk through and look at another wall, and you'll see the 2 obelisks on the barge, end to end, being towed. You can go even to the Sinai and visit the turquoise mines where Sneferu sent his expeditions. This is real history. If you go to Cairo, of course, on the outskirts at Giza, are the pyramids. You'll see the Great Pyramid. But go to the Egyptian Museum in Cairo. There you can visit the treasures of Tutankhamun. You can see the shrines that Howard Carter dismantled. You can see the coffins. But there's much better things than the treasures of Tutankhamun. Go to a side room where the jewelry is kept. And inside that is another side room. That's where you'll find the silver coffins of the Libyan kings of Tanis. That's where you'll find incredible treasures that no one looks at. Now, if you have time on your Egyptian trip, go south. Go to Thebes, of course. You'll have seen Deir el-Bahari. We talked about that. But there's much more there. Karnak Temple. Look at the history that we've been talking about. Go to Luxor Temple. You can actually walk the path of the Opet Festival. You can walk from Karnak Temple down an avenue of Sphinx through the town, they're just being excavated, to Luxor Temple, where the priests carried the statues of Amenmut and Khonsu. It's still there. And then go further south. Go to Aswan. And at Aswan, go to Philae, the island where all the Ptolemies built their temples. Don't forget in Aswan the unfinished obelisk. Get an idea of how big it was. That's where you should start your learning. Go to Egypt. But there are other sources. There are books to read. But there are organizations to join. And I urge you to do it. For example, the Egypt Exploration Society, which is in England. That's the one that started it all by excavating in the Delta in the 19th century. They publish a journal, the Journal of Egyptian Archaeology. Once a year, you can get the latest research in excavations. And now, given what you know, you'll understand it. You'll see familiar names. You'll see studies about Thutmose III, Cleopatra, Akhenaten. It'll mean something. You'll enjoy it. Closer to home, the Oriental Institute at the University of Chicago has a wonderful museum, but even perhaps more important, they have a correspondence course in hieroglyphs that you can take through the mail. You can learn to read and write hieroglyphs. Everyone can do it. I teach a course in hieroglyphs every year. My students, by the end of the year, can translate a short story in ancient Egyptian. So you can do it too. And if you can't get to a university, take the Oriental Institute's course. They also supply books. They will give you long lists of books that you can buy. It's something to do. Don't let it just go by. The American Research Center in Egypt is located in the United States. It's the professional organization of American Egyptologists, but it's open to everyone. We call it ARCE, American Research Center in Egypt, an acronym. It's open to everyone. And if you join, there are two tremendous benefits. One is you get the journal, which we call JARCE, Journal of the American Research Center in Egypt. It's readable, it's authoritative, and it'll give you the latest research in the field. But the second benefit of this organization is that they have an annual meeting in the United States where Egyptologists from all over the world come and present papers on their latest research. If you're interested in Akhenaten, you'll hear two or three papers on theories about what was Akhenaten doing. If you're interested in the military, you'll hear papers on the military. There are papers on medicine in ancient Egypt. On almost every aspect of Egyptology that we discuss, this society will tell you about it. And then, there's a wonderful popular magazine that everybody seems to love. It's kind of like an Egyptology Today magazine. It's called Kemet. K-M-T. It comes from the ancient Egyptian name for Egypt. Kemet. Right? A lot of people think it's K-M-T, but it's Kemet because they didn't write the vowels. And this gives you articles written by Egyptologists, but in a popular vein. It's highly illustrated. It has a book review section. And virtually everyone interested in Egyptology loves this publication. Loves it. So, as I said, it shouldn't end here. Now, remember one of my goals that I said at the very, very beginning? That I would hope that at the end of this long 48 lecture series, you would be able to take a friend and go to a museum, to their Egyptian collection. And the best ones to go to in America, Metropolitan Museum of Art has a fantastic collection. The Brooklyn Museum has a fantastic collection. The Boston Museum of Fine Arts has a fantastic collection. The Oriental Institute at the University of Chicago has a wonderful collection. There are plenty of places to go. But my goal was that you'd be able to take a friend and you be the guide and take her through the Egyptian section and that you'll be able to look at the art and say, ah, tired face, that must be Middle Kingdom. I guess it's Amenemhat Sesostris. You'll be able to see a woman dressed as king and know, ah, that's Hatshepsut. I think by now, I think you'll be able to do it. I think you will. And if you can, then at least one of my goals will have been met. So don't let it stop here. Continue reading and learning about Egyptology. And thank you for being with me so long. Bye.
I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. We hope you've enjoyed the lectures on these tapes. To order more courses or to receive a copy of our most recent catalog, call 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Or visit our website at www.teachco.com. Thank you very much for listening.